Seated, everyone. Welcome. This is the time set for oral argument in Parler versus Matzi. I hope I'm saying these names correctly. Case number 86495. Are counsel prepared to go ahead? Have you divided your time and know what how you're managing it? Okay. Please state on the record so the clerk can track it, what you're doing. And you will each have 2 minutes uninterrupted at the very beginning of each side's argument. But to the extent you're dividing argument, that only applies to the first up. So you may proceed.
Please the court, good morning. My name is Michael Coulson. I represent the appellant, Dan Bongino. There are two groups of appellants here. We've agreed to split our time equally. I'll be addressing the statement itself as Mr. Bongino is the speaker, and they'll be addressing the arguments as to the non-speakers. So I'd like to argue for 10 minutes and reserve roughly my remaining five in rebuttal.
Very well.
This case presents important issues of the constitutional right to free speech and Nevada's anti-SLAPP law. The facts themselves are straightforward, and I admit that they are unique. The statement being reviewed is about free speech advocacy. As a respondent, Mr. Mates alleges, he was the founder and the CEO of Parler, which was the conservative-leaning social media site that was intended to allow full free speech and protect it. Mr. Bongino, at the time that he made his statement, was a political commentator and a radio host, and he indirectly owned a small share in Parler. Mr. Bongino is a strong and outspoken advocate for the right to free speech, regardless of the issue, the side, or if he disagrees with the speaker. 1 week after Mr. Mates was fired by Parler, he instigated a public debate about the party's free speech views that was picked up in Fox. And just hours after that article was published, Mr. Bongino posted a video on his professional Facebook page quoting Mr. Mates' remarks in that Fox article and insisted that his free speech views are superior. This ironically resulted in defamation claims and the anti-SLAPP motions before you. The Nevada anti-SLAPP statute has been described as one of the strongest in the nation. That's why this court in Rosen v. Tarkanian holds that the speaker has a low burden of proof to show a statement is made in good faith, which includes an opinion. This court in Rosen also holds that the determination of good faith requires consideration of all the evidence in support of the motion. The evidence that was submitted in support of these motions shows the true context and the gist of this statement is an opinion over free speech advocacy, which undercuts these defamation claims altogether. Now, oddly enough, one of the primary disputes on appeal is what's actually in the record. In the briefing, Mr. Mates has argued there's absolutely nothing to support a showing of good faith except the statement itself. But that's just inaccurate. We also submitted Mr. Mates' remarks in the Fox article, which were authenticated by a declaration, as well as Mr. Bongino's deposition testimony, where he confirmed his statement was about his disagreement with Mr. Mates on messaging about censorship. He confirmed his statement was a public objection to Mr. Mates' characterization of censorship, and he expressly testified that the story he was referencing in his statement that he said was not correct was that Mr. Mates was really the advocate for free speech. And Mr. Bongino's big concern, as he testified, was for a larger free speech ecosystem. All of this evidence, including the state of mind evidence from Mr. Bongino's testimony, must be credited as true. And it shows that this is an opinion. In all speech cases, the context is key.
Counsel, can I ask you, did the court below consider any of this other evidence? Because the affidavit submitted by Mr. Bongino seems to just focus mostly on jurisdictional statements, which is understandable. I know that was before the court. But was did the court simply say the affidavit was insufficient or didn't address his personal intent? Or did the court then go on to review this other evidence, or did it just stop its analysis?
Well, I don't think that the court analyzed any of it. In the order on appeal, it says that there was no evidence submitted, not even a declaration that could have shown good faith. And the transcript of that argument shows that one question was asked by the court, and it was about attorney's fees. So respectfully, I think that the district court overlooked Mr. Mates' own remarks in Fox that Mr. Bongino quoted and cited to in his statement, as well as his supporting testimony.
And how does Mr. Mates' statements in the Fox leaked documents, how does that support his argument that the anti-SLAPP, that he's protected by anti-SLAPP?
Because Mr. Mates' quoted statement in the Fox article was, I met constant resistance to my strong belief in free speech at Parler. And Mr. Bongino began his statement by saying, and this was the context that I was just referring to. Mr. Mates said that in the Fox article. Just hours later, Mr. Bongino made his statement in response to, quote, the story on Fox News where Mates claims he was the real advocate for free speech. And Mr. Bongino reassured his audience, he's absolutely committed to free speech no matter what. And Mr. Bongino testified as much. He said his statement was in response to those remarks. He cites to the Fox article and he quotes Mr. Mates' remarks directly.
So whether Mr. Mates was in fact terminated because of his strong belief in free speech or not, why isn't that a fact? Why is that an opinion?
Because I don't believe that Mr. Bongino was opining about the reason for his termination. In his statement, he said that the relationship didn't work out because the parties didn't share the same vision. In the Fox article, it does not give a reason why Mr. Mates was terminated. And Mr. Bongino doesn't either, except for the one line in his statement where he's talked about the free speech visions were not the same. And that's why the relationship...
Isn't that the statement you just said Mr. Bongino was responding to?
No. Not the reason for the termination. There was no reason for Mr. Mates' termination given in that Fox article. There is no reason for Mr. Mates' termination given in Bongino's statement other than one passing line that says the relationship didn't work out because the free speech views were dissimilar. And in fact, even if a reasonable person under that standard were to read it that way, that would be true because Mr. Mates alleged as much, and that's what he told Fox. He alleges much in his complaint, I believe at paragraphs 41, 38. So even under that interpretation, it would be a true statement. Now, moving from the context to most important is the gist of the statement. We submit that the statement itself is sufficient to show the gist that Mr. Bongino is expressing his view that he's a stronger advocate for free speech. There are dozens of references to free speech, commitments to free speech, advocacy, competing visions and views. Again, the statement begins with the article on Fox where Mr. Mates claimed he was the real advocate, and it ends the same way. And I would submit that it's abundantly clear that both of these men are talking about their opinions. In the Fox article, Mr. Mates was quoted as saying, quote, I've met constant resistance to my product vision, my strong belief in free speech, and my view of how the Parler site should be managed. Mr. Bongino uses those same words, my vision, my belief, my commitments. And we, of course, have his testimony where he's point blank saying...
But someone's commitments or someone's views, and if you're expressing a disagreement about that or about what actually were the views, that's not necessarily a non-verifiable opinion.
Well, I don't think that they're expressing what the views were. I think they're opining about the magnitude of them. Both of them claimed that they were huge supporters for free speech.
Right.
who could ever say who was more of an advocate? Who could ever say was a stronger advocate for free speech? Whose vision was better? Whose beliefs are better? That's why this is an opinion. That's why the gist of this entire statement, and the only things quoted by Mr. Mates in that Fox article that was the predicate for this statement by ours, have to do with that. And we also believe that the testimony that Mr. Bongino submitted, as this court found in Williams v. Laser, affirms the gist that it was made without knowledge of falsehood, because it's an opinion.
Counsel, if we were to find that the prong one analysis or conducted by the court below should be reversed, we would then remand it back for further analysis of prong two, correct? Because I don't believe the court engaged in that analysis.
Respectfully, no, I don't think that would be correct. Although the court in its order said that it didn't, it actually did, because it made findings that are only relevant to prong two. It found that the statement was false, and it found that there was a coordinated attack to defame Mr. Mates. And those are both elements that are only relevant to prong two and on the two defamation claims. And if you were to find that prong one was sufficiently met, you would find it because the gist of Mr. Bongino's statement is an opinion, and that would then be applied to defeat the claims in prong two.
Or we could find that they were truthful or made without knowledge of its falsity. So it's not just the opinion off-ramp that we could take here.
Precisely.
And even though the court did make those kind of summary statements, there was really no analysis behind them, no kind of findings to support it. So I would probably think those would be deficient for purposes of appellate review anyway.
Well, I would just say that prong two was fully briefed by both sides. Mr. Mates argued that he met his burden, and I think that the de novo review here would also establish A, the opinion that would undercut the two claims, but B, under the clear and convincing standard, he did not establish actual malice, which he was required to do. He has a four-paragraph declaration that talks about personal animosity, which this court has found is irrelevant to this analysis. It's whether what I'm saying, I know it's false or reckless disregard. I've bled into my co-appellant's time. If there are any other questions, thank you.
Thanks, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Matthew Miller here, solely on behalf of appellant Mark Meckler. I'm planning to take about 12 minutes and would like to reserve roughly three of that for rebuttal if I can get the clock right. Might be a little shorter given the overlap here. Mr. Meckler is uniquely situated in this case for a number of reasons, the very first of which is that Mr. Meckler was never alleged to have made any defamatory statement about Mr. Mates, the plaintiff. While we agree with Mr. Colson's argument that Mr. Bongino's response to Mr. Mates' statements in Fox News was an opinion and therefore incapable of being false, there's independent reasons why Mr. Meckler met his burden under step one of the anti-slap. The first, if we look at the district court's order, the order says, the court further finds that via a declaration, defendant Meckler denied making February 3rd post, having any advanced knowledge that Bongino would be making the February 3rd post, or any knowledge that anything in the February 3rd post was false. If we stopped reading there, we'd probably think this was a different case, because it sure sounds like Mr. Meckler satisfied his prong one burden to show good faith, because he didn't know that anything in Mr. Bongino's statement was false at the time that it was made. But the district court continues and says,
does he now know that it was false? Because why did you disqualify that as at the time it was made?
Because the knowledge of a non-speaker defendant is relevant at the time that the statement was made, not later on. Other things that they might learn about the facts that Mr. Bongino or the opinion that Mr. Bongino made.
But under the Spiritos case, he has to address it based on the allegations made by the plaintiff.
Sure,
right?
And there were no allegations by the plaintiff that Mr. Meckler said anything, right? So there were allegations that Mr. Bongino made a Facebook Live video post on February 3rd. And so the district court's order does go on to say, as such, in claiming he had no involvement in the defamatory statement, it says they, because at the time we represented both Meckler and Parler, necessarily cannot satisfy the first prong of NRS 41663A, citing to the Spiritos case. We know if we look at Spiritos, Spiritos says that a defendant's denial of involvement in the allegedly defamatory statement is irrelevant at step one. It doesn't say that the denial is fatal at step one. It says that multiple times throughout that opinion. In fact, if you look at...
But it means ultimately he still has to respond to the statement as if he was responsible for it.
Well, in Mr. Meckler's declaration did that. He said, I had no knowledge that anything in the statement was false.
That's not going to a response to their allegation. Obviously, their allegation is he did know and was... I'm not saying evidence now, sure. But that's their allegation.
Sure. Well, they allege that there is a conspiracy that Mr. Meckler was involved in, and because of that conspiracy, he is liable for the things that were said in Mr. Bongino's post. Mr. Meckler's declaration says, I wasn't involved, I had no advanced knowledge, and I didn't know that anything was false. And so Spiritos doesn't say, again, that denial of involvement with the statement is fatal.
Does he actually assert that the statements made were true, or he didn't know they was false because were false? Because it seems like instead he's saying, I didn't have anything to do with it.
Well, his declaration does say that I had no knowledge that anything in the Bongino statement was false. He also argued in the motion that it was an opinion. We also included a declaration from someone involved in the attempts at negotiating a severance with Mr. Mates that the statements were in fact true. So we covered essentially a three-prong attack on prong one, saying we had no knowledge, or the statement was true, or it was an opinion.
He say it was true?
Well, the Richardson Declaration attests to various things, including some of the decision making leading up to Mace's termination. That says, among other things, that imprudent raises were given, that statements made to third parties led to Parler's deplatforming, and the Bongino statement goes on to make some comments. I think without specifically identifying Mace, that some really bad decisions were made leading up to that termination. So the district court said that Mr. Meckler's declaration established his knowledge that nothing in the February 3rd post was false, but that he necessarily could not avail himself of the anti-slap because of Spiritos. Spiritos, in turn, says a denial of involvement is not fatal. It's irrelevant. We look to the fact that Mr. Mace is trying to hold Mr. Meckler liable for this statement to determine whether the anti-slap can apply, and then we go on to see if Mr. Meckler met his burden to establish good faith, which, as I just stressed, we attacked via the opinion, via the truth, and via the lack of knowledge of falsity under 41637. It's telling that now on appeal, Mr. Mace takes a different tack, and his argument on appeal isn't Spiritos compels the district court or this court to deny Meckler's anti-slap motion because Mr. Meckler denied being involved in the statement. His argument now is, well, actually, Mr. Meckler's declaration had to attest to Mr. Bongino's state of mind and Mr. Bongino's knowledge at the time that Mr. Bongino made the statement. But this court said in Stark v. Lackey, in an en banc decision, I think just 5 years ago, that that's not the case. It said not only can a defendant avail themselves of the anti-slap when they're sued for third-party comments, but it also said that the affidavit there was sufficient, even though it didn't specifically attest to the truthfulness of the speaker who made the statements. The inquiry there was the knowledge or the state of mind of the defendant that was sued. And here we establish that by saying
that... Well, in Stark, they submitted an affidavit that said, the statements aren't false.
Sure, but
I don't know them to be false.
Right. There were two sets of statements in that case, I believe, one by the defendant and some were third-party posts made on a Facebook page that the defendant ran. But this court specifically said that Stark's affidavit was sufficient to attest to good faith, even though it didn't speak to the truthfulness of the speakers that made the statement. She included an affidavit that said, I didn't know, or, you know, I believe that the things that were said in these third party statements were false.
Yeah, that's not what Mr. Meckler has said here.
Sure, but we can satisfy our burden by showing that these statements were either true or we lacked knowledge that they were false. If we didn't know that the statements were false, it doesn't matter whether or not they are false under the standard, because we wouldn't have known it at the time.
But his basis for denying that they were false isn't because I've looked at the statements and they don't seem to be false to me. His basis for saying that goes back to his denial that he knew anything about it. But because I did not know that any statement was going to be made, I had no knowledge that anything in it was false.
Yes.
That's not a statement that nothing in there, or that I don't know anything in that whole statement is false.
Well, but it would be impossible for Mr. Meckler to attest to the truth or falsity of a statement that he didn't know was going to
happen in Stark.
Well, I suppose independently of that, we acknowledge the knowledge prong. We offered evidence from Mr. Richardson that these statements were in fact true, and we argued an opinion. So I think that when you are sued and there's no allegation that you made the statement, the way that you can satisfy, one of the ways you can satisfy good faith is by attesting to your lack of knowledge that the items in the statement were false. So this case, I would offer, is like, just like Stark, where the defendant there, Stark here, Mr. Meckler, was sued for third-party comments. There was a conspiracy claim in the Stark case, just like there's a conspiracy claim here. Stark denied making the statement. She said, in trying to invoke a Communications Decency Act argument, she said, look, I can't be held liable for these third-party posts. I didn't make them. Nevertheless, here is my declaration saying that I believe that they were true. And so we overlap with those four elements here. And we think that Stark should control the outcome here and require a reversal.
Go ahead.
Okay. Where in Meckler's affidavit does he say that these statements were true?
Well, he doesn't say that they were true. He says that I had no knowledge that statements were false
at the time they were made, because I didn't know they were being made. I mean,
correct,
that's what he says. But he doesn't tie that to a categorical statement that he didn't know that they were false.
I believe that's correct. The evidence that we offered as to the truth of the statements involved was the declaration from Mr. Richardson, who was involved in the management of Parler at the time, about the actual events that transpired leading up to Mr. Mates' termination.
And you're asking for a reversal, but wouldn't the better practice be a remand to allow the court, if we find good faith communication in the first prong, and the burden shifts and the court below is in the best position to do that fact finding in the first instance? Yes.
We briefed this. We agreed with Mr. Colson's argument that he put forward, that the court did in fact reach some of these merits determinations. They're only relevant under step two, that this was fully briefed. All the evidence was offered, in that, you know, depending on the reasons for reversal here, that remand might not be necessary, including if the statement itself is an opinion. I will turn it over to our final advocate here and reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Joe Akrotirianakis, excuse me, on behalf of Rebecca Mercer and NDMA. I join the comments of my colleagues. I won't repeat them, particularly the argument on behalf of Mr. Bongino. I rise separately only to address the point that, as the court is aware, my clients, neither of them submitted a declaration. I think that that's covered by this court's precedent in the Rosen versus Tarkanian decision. Both the majority opinion and the dissent reference not an absolute requirement for a declaration in the circumstances. You consider the record as a whole here. There is other evidence in the record, because there are multiple defendants, movements, who are before the court. And this case is somewhat differently situated in the sense that in many anti-SLAPP litigations, the motion is made right at the outset of the case. You don't have the deposition testimony and other matters that are of record before this court. In that sense, it is somewhat unique. I have no further comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Boyce.
Good morning, members of the court. May it please the court, Todd Bice on behalf of respondent John Mates. This appeal stems from one aspect of the district court's March 31, 2023 order dealing with the slap motion. But that order is itself just part of five interrelated orders that the district court issued. These four other orders, three of which concern personal jurisdiction and were entered on March 3 of 2023, are included in our supplemental appendix to our answering brief. And as I'll address, the district court's decision here should be sustained both on its express terms as well as for the other grounds that are provided in the record below. That March 31 order was not written on a blank slate. Nearly a month earlier, the district court had made a number of very detailed factual findings and conclusions of law concerning the personal jurisdiction motions that were all joined together. These motions were, in fact, I'll use Mr. Bongino as an example. He filed a single motion. It was a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction and a slap motion. And there were rounds of briefing surrounding these various motions. They were all intertwined together. The district court ultimately had to address the personal jurisdiction motions first because it obviously couldn't exercise jurisdiction over the 12B motions or the slap motions unless it determined that it had personal jurisdiction over the defendants who were raising those arguments. So in doing so, it made specific, explicit factual findings about how he had met his prima facie case concerning the various claims that had been asserted here, because the claims turned on specific jurisdiction. There was no general jurisdiction over these defendants. There were specific jurisdiction. So that's why the district court, if you look, we attach those orders as our appendix, because they explain the history leading up to ultimately the district court's slap motion or slap ruling, as well as its ruling on the 12B five grounds that they were asserted. And as the defendant and as the district court found, the defendants each had opposed holding any type of evidentiary hearing. And those orders briefly summarize what has given rise to this case. I don't need to go into the whole history of it. You know, Parler is a social media or was a social media platform. It no longer exists because it has gone defunct as a result, frankly, of this lawsuit. It's analogous to what we would all call Twitter or X or whatever it's known as today. Mr. Mates had handled the day-to-day operations, and this was his baby. As Mr. Warnick had testified, who was also one of the smaller owners of the company, you know, Mr. Mates lived and breathed Parler. Ms. Mercer was the other founding member of it, and Ms. Mercer supposedly had her involvement through this company called MDM Ascendant. But as the district court found in its personal jurisdiction ruling, MDM Ascendant and the various people appointed under it, which included Mr. Meckler, were in fact simply the people that took direction from Ms. Mercer. There's no evidence, as the district court found, that they actually followed any corporate formalities, that in fact Ms. Mercer made all the decisions. She was the one deciding what money would be spent. She had final approval over everything. And in fact, as the district court even noted in its ruling on personal jurisdiction, MDMA didn't even have a bank account until after Mr. Mates filed lawsuit. They tried to create, Mr. Meckler and the company tried to create the appearance that this MDMA entity was somehow a real entity when in fact, after the lawsuit was filed, when in fact it wasn't one. What gives rise to this claim is the effort to seize control of the company and to remove Mr. Mates. That's what transpired here. Mr. Mates was, again, the founder of the company. Ms. Mercer wanted him out. In fact, this plan had started early discovery had shown, and the jurisdictional discovery showed, that Mr. Richardson was sent to Nevada by Ms. Mercer directly.
Hey, counsel, can we just focus on the communication at issue?
Yes.
Because we're our review is very narrowly cabined into the last two causes of action that you've pled here. In terms of the Facebook Live transcript,
yes.
What part of this transcript are you taking issue, or your client taking issue with, in terms of being false statements?
Your Honor, the statement is fairly lengthy. We actually played for the district court, because it's a recording. We actually played it live so that the district court could hear to determine the entire gist and sting of the entirety of the statement.
Do you agree that the transcribed version of that is accurate?
Yes, we don't believe, we didn't dispute the transcribed version as being accurate. We don't think it conveys the full gist of the statement itself, because you needed to hear, and this is why we played it directly for the district court, so that it could hear Mr. Bongino and his attack upon Mr. Mates.
You're saying that we should be considering the tone as well?
Well, I do think that the tone plays into it, particularly when the court is trying to assess the gist and sting of any particular statement. And so, but the transcript itself, we aren't contesting the accuracy of it in terms of what was said.
Correct.
We certainly maintain that statement was part of the broader campaign, and the district court actually found that it was part of the broader campaign to effectuate Mr. Mace's removal, to bully him out of the company, to try and get him to release his interest in the company. When he would not do that, Mr. Warnick, and the district court found this, foretold that this attack would be made. If you don't sign this document that was presented by Mr. Meckler through presented by Ms. Mercer through Mr. Meckler, Mr. Bongino will go on social media and ruin your reputation. He was told that, just like he was told they will bury you in legal fees, so here, sign this document giving up your ownership in Parler. He refused, and within days of his refusal, the attack happened, just as it was foretold. And the district court recognized this was all part of an organized plan to effectuate Mr. Mates' removal.
Okay.
To take his
Can we go back to Justice Lee's question? So what about it was false?
What about it was false? The entire gist and sting of the statement was false, because the statement is about the grounds for Mr. Mates' termination from the company. That's how it starts off. And the first words right out of it, so it's time to correct the record. That's how he starts the statement. Then he starts talking about Mr. Mates' removal by the board. Then he starts talking about the advocacy for product stability, which, of course, is how the business was operated. And, in fact, accuses Mr. Mates of lying about that. And lying about the reasons, ultimately, for why Mr. Mates was terminated and forced out of the company, which is what they did just days after this attack happened. So if you go through it, right, they talk about supposed bad decisions were made. Well, it's obvious from the context of that statement he's accusing Mr. Mates of that, and then he's accusing Mr. Mates of lying about it.
Well, even if you say that bad decisions were made, I mean, that is, how do you prove actually that to be false? I'm searching the record, and I understand maybe if we heard it, maybe we would be excited by the tone and emotionally persuaded, but when we're just looking at the record, I understand he prefaces it with, he was terminated by the board of Parler, which is not a factually inaccurate statement. Then he kind of goes on this kind of just winding road of what I just think is a stream of consciousness. But I don't see anything in here that I can point to that says that is a false statement. It's like if he stole money from the company, if he did something like that. I mean, to this, it just seems like a bunch of, as I say, who shot John? I don't know.
Right. Well, he goes on, right? So I agree with you. If you take each statement, take the statement about Mr. Mace was terminated, if you take that in isolation, you would say, well, that's true. But that's why you don't look at each statement in isolation. You look at the gist and sting of the entirety of the attack. Mm-hmm. Why did he bring up the fact that Mr. Mace was terminated and then proceed to talk about product stability being shut down by Amazon, etc.? because he was going to attack Mr. Mates, just as Mr. Warnick had foretold, and try and ruin his reputation in this business. And that's what he then proceeds to do. It was some terrible decisions were made in the past that led to this. That led to us getting shut down by Amazon and others. That's, again, a verifiable fact. Is that true or is that false? Mr. Mates says this is false. He then goes on, Mr. Bongino goes on to accuse Mr. Mates of lying. Mr. Mates is lying about all of this. Well, that, again, is a provable statement. He then goes on to say he's not telling the truth there, and the product stability, he was committed to product stability. Wait until the real story comes out. He's, again, conveying the fact that Mr. Mates was the one not committed to product stability, again, suggesting this is why he was fired, and again, saying that there are other facts that are going to come out that will somehow prove the validity of his statement.
This may seem obvious at this point, but I just want to make sure I understand where, and maybe it's not clear, what is meant on the product stability. Is that talking about keeping Parler up and running as opposed to being shut down under the terms of service by Amazon or these others? Is that kind of what the idea is?
Yeah, product stability being, so what ultimately Amazon cited as an example were the some of the failure to moderate some of the extremism that was happening on these social media platforms, including Parler.
Right.
And as the court, you know, I think it was, you know, fairly well known that there were other, Twitter was an example. Others were being accused of failing to having moderated some of the extremism that was out there. Well, Parler was accused of that similarly by Amazon as well as, I apologize, I don't remember the other company that was providing the platforming at the time, but Amazon was certainly one of them. Apple was the other one.
Right.
So that's what they're talking about in terms of product stability, which Mr. Bongino is trying to lay at the feet of Mr. Mates. That's what he's doing.
But didn't they just have a disagreement?
That's a false statement.
Wasn't there just a disagreement about content moderation generally between the different factions of Parler? So Mr. Mates saw that the content moderation would potentially save their existence on these platforms, whereas the other faction said, no, we're free speech. It doesn't matter how extreme. It doesn't matter, you know, whatever. And so this, there's a kind of a visionary difference between the parties. And so you're expressing those competing views because everyone's saying we're all about free speech,
right,
but how we represent that on the platform is just two differing ways of going about that.
But Justice Lee, that's not a statement of opinion. That's a statement about what were the respective parties' positions about how the company should and shouldn't be operated. That's a provable fact about what their statements were, about what their positions were. And in fact, he closes out that statement. The attack on Mr. Mates was, you'll see my story is 100% true because it's not a story. It's facts. This is coming directly from what Mr. Bongino said. He is the one declaring that he has the facts. Mr. Mates is a liar. Mr. Mates is lying about what happened at Parler.
So is it, I mean, I guess ultimately the heart of the, well, this piece of the dispute anyway is, you know, is this like the statements in the Wazer case, the Williams versus Wazer, you know, that statements that someone's a racist, there's a statement of opinion. And so similarly here is saying that someone, you know, he says he's the First Amendment advocate, but we're the First Amendment advocates. Everyone knows we're the First Amendment advocates. Isn't it just that sort of opinion and not verifiable fact?
No, because that's not what the debate here was. Again, this was on the heels of their termination of Mr. Mates.
Right.
Okay? Because and you just heard Mr. Miller contradict Mr. Bongino's argument, right? Mr. Bongino's argument is, oh, this statement was solely about the free speech, my position or Mr. Bongino's position about the merits of free speech vis-a-vis Mr. Mates, whereas Mr. Meckler is essentially contradicting it by acknowledging that Mr. Bongino was pontificating about the grounds for Mr. Mates' termination from the company, which had happened just days earlier. So that termination happened on the 29th. Mr. of January. Mr. Bongino went on the attack just as Mr. Warnick had warned him was going to happen. If you don't sign the document, you're going to get attacked by Bongino and ruin your reputation because he's the attack dog. February 3 comes around, and Mr. Bongino wants to tell the story that, oh, it was only prompted by this Facebook, by this Fox News article. But again, look at the context of the entirety of what was transpiring. Warnick admitted the plan was to get him out, and to get him out by basically trying to not pay him anything.
But it doesn't this all go to the step two of the analysis, of the anti-SLAPP analysis? I mean, at step one, we're just looking at whether or not the statements were truthful, or if they were, because we all agree it falls within one of the four protected categories of speech, right? Because it's public interest. So then our analysis is cabined to whether or not the statements were truthful or made with reckless disregard for
without knowledge
of their falsity. So if we're looking at does that, and then not moving on to prong two yet,
right?
Just keep me in prong one and explain to me how these statements are not truthful, or how Mr. Bongino or the other defendants made them without knowledge of their.
Sure. So let me deal with Mr. Bongino first. Mr. Sure. Bongino did not submit a declaration. And I think that's very, very telling, and the district court noted that. Now, his counsel argues that, well, he submitted testimony from his deposition. Well, that's a little misleading. Mr. Bongino was deposed about personal jurisdiction, and he refused to answer questions about the Facebook Live post. And in fact, that's addressed in another one of the orders we attached to you from Judge Denton, where he ruled that went to the merits, so therefore he denied our motion to compel those answers about the Facebook Live post when it pertained to personal jurisdiction. So contrary to what you just heard, no, there was no deposition that went to the merits about Mr. Bongino's, the falsity of Mr. Bongino's statements. And that order is at supplemental appendix pages 5 and 6 that we submitted to the court. So he didn't submit any declaration. But what he did admit in his deposition on personal jurisdiction is he actually had no knowledge or involvement in Mr. Mates' termination and the grounds for it, even though he published that statement referencing Mr. Mates' termination and then proceeded to insinuate that the reason for Mr. Mates' termination was because of all of the reasons that Mr. Bongino was offering out to the public. And he wanted that to be spread widely amongst the public. He even closed off that publication by saying, please spread the word about what he was saying about Mr. Mates to his more than 37,000 viewers on this. So in fact, he didn't know why Mr. Mates was terminated. The district court had detailed its findings in its personal jurisdiction ruling at supplemental appendix page 18, including Mr. Mates' involvement in the conspiracy to force Mr. Mates out of the company. That's what the district court had already found that a month before it had entered this order, that Mr. Bongino was involved in the organized effort to try and force him out. They were going to bully him out, and this was part of the plan, to bully him out of the company. So Mr. Bongino didn't submit any declaration saying, I believe my statements to be truthful, because he knew they weren't truthful, because he wasn't involved in Mr. Mates' termination. He wanted it to appear that he was, and that's what his statement goes on to detail. He talks about we throughout his statement, he and the other owners. That's how he tries to convey the message that Mr. Mates was terminated by the other owners because of misconduct by Mr. Mates. But Mr. Bongino's entire statement was false. Mr. Bongino wasn't involved in that at all. He didn't know anything about it. But he wanted to smear Mr. Mates, and so he proceeded to do that. And so that's why the judge correctly noted that under prong one, Mr. Bongino didn't submit any evidence to the court establishing that the statement was true or that he didn't have knowledge of its falsity, because his deposition actually proved that he didn't have any basis for making those statements.
We could review the actual statement itself and come to the conclusion that it's an opinion without an affidavit, correct?
You could come to the statement, a question of opinion does not turn upon the submission of an affidavit. I agree with that. But the question of opinion is one that the court ultimately has to decide. But nonetheless, you have to look at the entirety of the statement and the gist and sting of the entirety of the statement.
And that's a de novo review, correct?
That is de novo review, and I agree with that. But to the extent that there is any question about whether or not it's one of opinion or fact, because oftentimes statements can be deemed to contain both aspects of opinion and fact, it's ultimately then left to the jury to decide whether or not the statement was one of fact. Here, again, that is a question that would still have to go back to the jury as to whether or not it's a mixed question of opinion or fact. But in this particular case, Justice Lee, Mr. Bongino repeatedly insisted that these were the facts. He didn't say, there's not a single reference to opinion or in my opinion or my this or my that. It was always statements of facts. Mates is lying. What he's saying is untrue. What happened is this. All of those are verifiable and will be proven as untruthful because this was all part of the broader plan, as the district court found. This was all part of the broader plan to get him out, to force him to give up his interest in the company for virtually for free. And that's what they did. They actually, when that didn't work, when he refused to sign that, a week later on February the 12th, they redeemed his interest in this company, claiming it was worth $3 whole. They were simultaneously telling everybody else this company was worth tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. And they redeemed him for
three. Can you address those other than Bongino that
yes.
you were alluded to?
So let me deal with Mr. Meckler, because I think Mr. Meckler is a very interesting effort of hair splitting with his declaration. If you look at what Mr. Meckler says, right, he doesn't actually say, and this is why the record proves that Mr. Meckler knew it was untruthful, because Mr. Meckler, in his opening motion, submitted a declaration from Mr. Richardson. Didn't submit a declaration from himself. He submitted one from Mr. Richardson. And what does Mr. Richardson say? Does he say the statements that Bongino said are truthful, or I don't know that those to be false? Oh, no, he doesn't say that at all. He actually says that the reason for Mr. Mates' termination culminated from Mr. Mates using Parler funds to retain legal counsel in anticipation of the congressional hearings or the federal investigation that was going to follow the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Mr. Mates had used company funds to retain lawyers, and they said he wasn't authorized to do that. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. You'll notice that's not what Bongino was claiming in his attack upon him that had occurred just days later. In fact, so Mr. Meckler submitted a declaration that directly contradicts what Bongino had said. Then when it turns around and we call out Mr. Meckler in our opposition brief, he then submits his own declaration for the first time in his reply, and he's very careful to parse the words. He says, because I didn't know that he was going to make the statement, I didn't know it was going to be false. Not that the statements are true, because Mr. Meckler knows they're not true. Because Mr. Meckler is the person who supposedly was the one responsible for terminating Mr. Mates, who supposedly said that it was the reasons being the use of company funds to retain lawyers in anticipation of the federal investigations. So Mr. Meckler's own submittal and his opening motion proves that he knew the statements that Bongino made weren't true. His only defense, what he argues here, is, well, I'm not responsible because I didn't know he was going to make them. But that, of course, is addressed by the conspiracy count. When you are a part of, and Judge Denton had ruled in the motion dealing with Ms. Mercer on personal jurisdiction, that she and Meckler were part of a conspiracy to force Mr. Mates out of the company. And what the law is what when you are a party to a conspiracy, and that conspiracy includes claims of defamation, you are then liable for the underlying defamation, because that was part of the conspiracy that you all participated in trying to force Mr. Mates out of the company. And the district court judge had already found, even preceding this order, that we had satisfied that with prima facie evidence. So Mr. Meckler's arguments, again, he didn't submit a declaration saying that what Bongino said was truthful. And he didn't say that what Bongino said, I don't know, to be not truthful. What he said, he uses again, he parses those words at the time. he made the statement. I didn't know it was coming.
Well, the court didn't find out that there was a conspiracy to commit defamation. It was just it's a broader scheme of the theft and the ousting and the whatnot. So just focusing in on the claims of defamation.
Yes.
Did the court find that the parties conspired to defame your client, Mr.
Well, Lee? I think so there's two aspects to that. There's in the order on the October 31 order.
Mm-hmm.
He actually does say that this was part of a broader effort to let me find the exact words. Right. The February 3rd post was Mates presented sufficient evidence that this was a coordinated effort to defame him. So the district judge did make that finding as part of that order. And then if you look back at the other jurisdictional orders pertaining to Mr. Warnick and Ms. Mercer in particular, the court details in its findings all of the events leading up to the defamatory statement and the warning from Mr. Warnick that Mercer was going to have Bongino attack him on social media if he didn't. I mean, it's very telling, isn't it, that Mr. Warnick knew in advance this was coming? It wasn't an accident that this attack was made. Mr. Warnick had warned days before, if you don't sign the release, giving up your interest in the company, this is what's going to happen to you. And the minute he refused, I shouldn't say the minute, days within his refusal, here it comes. This was all, as the district court said, there's ample evidence in the record to support the district court's conclusion that this was a coordinated effort amongst the defendants. Because as soon as they couldn't get him out, they then redeemed him for $3 for a company that they claimed and were telling everybody else was worth tens of, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. So let me deal then, lastly, let me deal with the few minutes I have left. I'll deal with Ms. Mercer's arguments. All right. Ms. Mercer's motion consisted of a one-page joinder in Mr. Meckler's motion to the district court. She didn't submit any declarations. She didn't present any evidence that the statements that Bongino made were truthful or that she somehow didn't know that they were false. But we actually, from the evidence in the district court's findings, particularly as to personal jurisdiction, know that she knew those statements were false. And the reason she knew they were false was because she was the one who ultimately had to admit she's the one who made the decision regarding Mr. Meeks' termination. Contrary to what Mr. Bongino, the spin he was out there publishing wide to the public, Ms. Mercer was the one who ultimately was making the decisions about Mr. Meeks' termination. And she didn't dare submit a declaration saying that anything of what Bongino said was truthful, because it wasn't. And she didn't dare submit a declaration saying that I didn't know what he was saying I knew it was untruthful. Yes, the phrase it. My apologies. The point being, she submitted nothing. And she can't be claiming she satisfied her prong one burden when she didn't bother to submit any form of evidence. She submitted a one-page joinder. And I don't even think she submitted a reply brief, is my recollection at the district court proceedings. But again, the district court's findings on her role in this scheme, in its findings on personal jurisdiction, I mean, the district court went into fairly substantial details about her control, her directions. She's the one that organized this. She's the one that orchestrated Meeks' removal. And that she is the one I'll double check the record, but I'm pretty sure he even used the word conspiracy, that she was in a conspiracy with Mr. Meckler. And yes, this is at page supplemental appendix 49, where the court found that Mr. Meeks had presented evidence that Mercer conspired with the other defendants, including Meckler. So such that she is subject to personal jurisdiction under the conspiracy theory of personal jurisdiction.
Mr. Weiss, could you just briefly talk about the Herring Networks case versus Maddow in California? It's the Ninth Circuit case.
Yes.
And there they credited Rachel Maddow's op-ed style of reporting, and she uses fiery and Reddit hyperbole all the time. Her audience knows that this is kind of her thing. Is there any credit to be given to Mr. Bongino under that case?
No, because in that particular case, so you got to recognize in that particular case, Ms. Maddow's reporting was basically just she was doing reporting as a reporter. Here, Mr. Bongino is an owner. He's acting in pursuit of his own business interests here. He was, unlike Ms. Maddow, who the court had credited there with, she was just doing reporting. Yes, perhaps she had engaged in some hyperbole, but that was the nature of her reporting. There was no dispute that it was quote unquote reporting as a media source. Here, Mr. Bongino took to his airwaves, not as part of some ordinary programming. He specifically went out of his way. Thank you very much. I appreciate the court's time.
Just address a few points before turning it back over to Mr. Colson here. So we heard a lot from Mr. Mace's counsel about what sounds like argument on the merits about whether or not a conspiracy actually existed. And a lot of that stemmed from some of the defendants challenging the court's personal jurisdiction. Just to be clear, Mr. Meckler didn't challenge personal jurisdiction in this case. There was not discovery from Mr. Meckler about personal jurisdiction. We essentially kind of sat on the sidelines while those motions were resolved. And so there weren't findings made about whether or not the court had personal jurisdiction over Mr. Meckler because Mr. Meckler didn't challenge the court's personal jurisdiction there. If we take a step back, we're also faulted for essentially the way that we approach our arguments here, including the inclusion of the Richardson declaration with our opening anti-slap motion and the Meckler declaration in the reply. If you recall, the complaint here essentially identifies the defamation claim, I think, in two paragraphs saying that Bongino went on a rant on Facebook and said that he was, quote, pissed. And that was what we were left with to determine what the statement was, what the plaintiff was alleging to be false in that statement or defamatory in that statement. And so in our anti-slap motion, yes, we said, okay, we think we can find this. We found it on the Facebook video, and there were a number of statements made. And we said, well, we can meet our burden by showing that these are true. We can meet our burden by showing that these are an opinion. We took both routes, as I addressed earlier. The Richardson Declaration addressed many of the reasons that Mr. Mace was, in fact, terminated. The lead up to his termination, including statements that he made in the press that ultimately led to or were cited in Apple, Google, and Amazon's letters deplatforming Parler, leading up to, yes, what Mr. Bice addressed with the retaining company funds so that he could get counsel for the congressional investigation. And so we said, well, if you look at some of the statements that Bongino made, they look to us like they're true. Other parts of it look like they're his opinion. Who's the superior advocate on free speech? That's not something that we can resolve, that reasonable people on a jury can resolve. That's something we can certainly pound our chest about all day and argue who the superior advocate is. But the fact that some of the statement was true and some of the statement was an opinion inures to our benefit here rather than harms us. I'll take about 30 more seconds and then turn it over. We're also faulted for including Mr. Meckler's declaration with a reply. That was after we saw in the response to our anti-slap motion what they were actually claiming to be the false and defamatory statements, and Mr. Meckler could review those and attest to his knowledge about the statement at the time it was made, including the fact that he couldn't know that it was that anything said was false because he didn't know that the statement was going to be made. Unless you have any questions for me, I'll turn the last 2 minutes, 3 minutes over to Mr. Colson. Thank you.
Very well, thanks.
So I'd like to just get back to first principles. The obvious context here, I think it's telling why in the briefing and really now we're not hearing anything about Mr. Mates's own comments that were in Fox or about the Fox article itself. We heard about an effort to remove him. He was fired a week before this article came out and Mr. Bongino's statement. Mr. Bongino made his statement from a hotel room on the couch. Why then? Because this article in Fox just got published hours before. That's the timing of these events. That is the context. Mr. Bongino cites the Fox article. Mr. Bongino quotes Mr. Mates. That's the context. Why did he bring up he was fired? Because Fox reported it. And Mr. Mates' departure memo that he wrote got leaked to Fox. So that's the only reason why he said it. The gist, this is the most important, okay? He could not answer the question about what in this statement was false. We're hearing a lot about implied defamation. Well, first of all, the reasonable person standard, there's nothing about misconduct or cause or any of the other adjectives in the brief alleged or said with specificity. So how could a reasonable person infer that from this statement? What we have instead is cherry picking these two comments about bad decisions and terrible decisions, and you hit it on the head. That's an opinion. That is not verifiable at all. What we're doing here is we're parsing words to ignore a clear gist of this statement, and we're scrutinizing what Mr. Bongino didn't say to try to find a defamatory
meaning.
Isn't
the gist that Mr. Mates is lying about the reasons for his termination?
No. Respectfully, the gist is that Mr. Mates said that I met constant resistance at Parler to my product vision, my strong belief in free speech.
In his memo about his termination.
Well, wasn't published in Fox.
Right.
That's the first statement in the Fox article, and that's what Mr. Bongino leads with in his statement.
Right.
That's what he's saying. I was the advocate, not him. And, you know, we heard some about, you know, Mr. Bongino calling him a liar. You're allowed to call someone a liar in a debate. The context is everything. And what he said was, quote, John's statements that he made in this leaked memo, those are not true. We are committed. I had some other points to make. I'm over. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.